Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a humble hero. GM goes public again, hard politics, and a narrow verdict for a Guantanamo detainee. Army Staff Sergeant Salvatore Junta was awarded the Medal of Honor by President Obama for courage in Afghanistan. He was the first living soldier to receive the medal since Vietnam.
Although I'm the one standing here wearing this medal right now, I want to make it be known that this represents all service members from all branches that have been in Afghanistan since 2001, Iraq since 2003. Who were there yesterday are there today and will go again tomorrow.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has signed off on maybe $1 billion in earmarks in the past 2 years. This week, he said, the practice must end.
What I've concluded is that on the issue of congressional earmarks, as the leader of my party in the Senate, I have to lead first by example.
And the first Guantanamo detainee tried in civilian court was convicted on just one of more than 200 counts, acquitted on the rest because of torture. Here's defense attorney Peter Quinjano.
Where in the shadow of the World Trade Center, this jury acquitted Ahmed Halfan Gilani of 284 out of 285 counts.
This hour on Point, it's our weekly news roundtable with Michael Crowley, senior correspondent for Time Magazine, Aaron Bellings, deputy editor for Roll Call, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Michael Crowley, Aaron Bellings, Jack, it's great to have all of you with us. Let's go straight, if we may, Michael, to the nuclear treaty that's on the line here. President Obama already in Lisbon now talking with NATO. He'll talk with the Russian leader soon, I guess. But Republicans on the floor of the Senate this week saying no, it may have been up on the rails and presumed ready to go. John Kyle saying no, not now, not until the next Congress. What's going on, Michael?
Well, I think the White House is a little bit surprised by the roadblock that's been thrown up here. Senator Kyle has essentially been the proxy for the Republican Senate caucus on this, and they're kind of taking his lead. A few days ago, the White House had been negotiating with Kyle and came up with several billion extra dollars to sort of maintain and modernize the U.S. nuclear arsenal and production facilities. And they felt like, okay, Kyle got what he needed, and he's going to go back to Republicans and say, we can do this treaty. And it looks like that's not going to happen. And now Kyle is saying he doesn't like it. Conservatives are redoubling their opposition en masse. And, the view, I think, from a lot of Democrats is that this is essentially an attempt to deny the president a victory, to sort of stop anything that he can call a success at any cost. Conservatives say that the treaty gave too many concessions to the Russians, makes us look weak, in particular undermines our ability to mount missile defense programs. I would just say that the big picture point that I take here is mm-hmm. that, you know, this is sort of a new generation of Republicans on foreign policy. I mean, if you look at who is with the White House on this, you're talking about people like Henry Kissinger, Brent Scowcroft, and the one Republican in the Senate, Dick Lugar, who was the ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who is really, you know, kind of a foreign policy mandarin, respected on both sides of the aisle. But there's sort of a new brigade of conservatives who see foreign policy differently than those old kind of venerable Washington hands. And there's a real rift here in the Republican Party over how America should handle things like international treaties. And I think that says a lot about the direction of the Republican Party right now.
Aaron Bellings, there was a time, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was on Capitol Hill this week reminding senators that politics ended at the water's edge. There was at least the notional idea of unity when it came to foreign policy. What's happening to that, Aaron?
I don't know where bipartisanship is anymore. Certainly, that's the case that the administration is making right now. Republicans are digging in, as Michael said, and it doesn't look like it's going anywhere anytime soon. Obviously, we don't have a lot of time in this lame duck session. The president has said this is his number one priority. But, unless there is some breakthrough within the next week or two, I don't see how it gets done. I mean, we're talking about getting out of here maybe the second week of December. Mm-hmm. So time is of the essence. But certainly the administration is making the case that this is essential and it's got to happen now. But to Michael's point, I think a lot of this is politics. I mean, you know, the Republicans are newly emboldened. They just won back the House. They've gained seats in the Senate. And they want to throw their weight around. And this is a big political fight as much as anything.
It takes a two-thirds vote to ratify a treaty. That's 67 votes in the Senate. And the White House signaling now that it's going to go for the showdown here, that it's going to go and try and get that vote. Here's a little sense of the kind of language you've heard from Republicans this week. This is Ohio Republican Senator George Voinovich talking about how passage of the treaty would be dangerous and the wrong message to Moscow. Let's listen.
The Obama administration's inaction and reluctance to confront Russia on its human rights record sends a dangerous signal to Moscow that there are little or no consequences for bad behavior. At a minimum, such coddling of bad behavior by the West only serves to embolden Moscow.
There's the pushback from George Voinovich. But, of course, Richard Lugar was on the floor of the Senate talking very differently. Ranking Republican member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he's been on the nuclear front for a long, long time now and was saying this is just irresponsible. We need this new START treaty to get some kind of regime back over nuclear weapons in the United States and Russia, some kind of agreement to contain this relationship and more than this relationship.
Any one of those warheads could obliterate the city of Indianapolis. There are thousands still there. The American public might have forgotten about it. Senators may have forgotten about it. We are deeply concerned about North Korea and Iran and other programs in which there may be 1, 2, 5, 20. We're talking about thousands of warheads that are still there, an existential problem for our country.
Jack Beatty, I think you saw the Republicans' kind of senior statesman on the nuclear weaponry front stand up and make that speech on the floor of the Senate.
I haven't seen that kind of language out of Senator Lugar in the 35-odd years I've been watching him. He has now gone ahead and said to the White House, call their bluff, have a vote on this. That's something from his own caucus. And I think, you know, there have already been rumors of this. I think the chances of him facing a primary opponent in Indiana, I think he's up in 2012, increase. So it's a brave stand by the senator. And, you know, the claim that Senator Kyle makes that, well, we need to discuss this more. I mean, there have been voluminous hearings. We need to look at it in the next Congress. Well, of course, in the next Congress, the White House would need not 9 GOP senators, as it needs now to get to the two-thirds. It would need 14, which would be almost impossible. So it's a clearly transparently disingenuous excuse to say put it off to the next Congress. Essentially, that says kill it. I'm struck by the editorial comment. Yes, you have the New York Times saying Iran should send Senator Kyle a thank you note, this because Russia has been helpful on Iran, mm-hmm. and the L.A. Times, of course. But you also get Utah's Deseret News. You've got the Bangor Daily News. You've got the Christian Science Monitor. You've got local papers. All of them really coming right out and saying, this looks like politics on a crucial matter of national security. And it may be that the Republicans are going to take note of that, there's a line and a sense that, you know, maybe this will hurt us if we for the first time in 80 years since the Treaty of Versailles deny a president of a treaty.
Aaron Billings, I don't know if President Obama is calling the Republicans bluff or preparing to go down on principle here. Are there the numbers? Can you tell? Are there enough Republicans ready to break ranks and vote for ratification of this treaty? Or does it look like the president will fail? It will go to the next Senate.
I don't think he has the votes. I mean, you know, 67 is a pretty high number. And as you know, the Senate can't really get much done with 60. So 67 seems next to impossible, particularly when you have people like John Kyle and John McCain and other, defense hawks digging in. I just don't see it at this point. But, you know, then again, stranger things have happened.
Michael Crowley, this was the week when Republicans told the president they didn't have time to meet on Thursday for a sort of breaking of bread that he had put out there just after the election. What are we seeing here? There was talk that maybe there would be a tiny window of cooperation here before everybody got back in the trenches. All gone?
There's always talk in Washington that there's a window of cooperation right around the corner. And, you know, I think it's become Lucy in the football in some way. I mean, you know, think back to this. George Bush ran in 2000 on the idea that he was going to change, you know, end the partisan bickering in Washington and bring people together. And then Barack Obama ran in 2008 on a similar theme. And now after the midterm elections, well, maybe people can get together. I think the reality is we should stop expecting people to get together. And I think the reality is that Republicans feel very emboldened. They probably feel less reason than ever to do that. And I think that, you know, from a Republican perspective, it's probably Obama who benefits the most from bipartisan cooperation, that this was a promise that he made. This is something that he has tried to place at the center of his political identity, that he can be a bridge builder, that he can transcend partisan differences. And I think Republicans feel right now like they hold a lot of the cards. They don't really need to do that. They don't really get much out of it. I think they feel that, you know, on a couple of occasions where there have been high-profile confabs, like that televised meeting they had with the president several months ago, where they kind of got to stand up something a la Question Time and make their points, and then he would respond, I think, you know, did not work out particularly well for them, and they're not terribly interested in repeating that. So I think that, you know, there was maybe a hopeful brief window. It's closed. I wouldn't expect to see it reopen, and I would say that this is how Washington is these days. I don't see it changing.
But here's Senator Lugar saying this should not be about politics. This should be about the real security of the country. Michael Crowley with Time Magazine, stand by. This is On Point. Get a lot of talk about earmarks. Tea Partiers really want those shut down. Here's Republican Senator Jim DeMint, big hero to the Tea Party, saying this week he thinks Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell's move to back a ban on earmarks signals a change, a real change on Capitol Hill. This is courtesy of CBS's The Early Show.
He listened to fellow Republicans, but more importantly, he listened to the voters. Parochial, wasteful pork barrel earmarks have been wasting money for years here, and it's kept our focus on local parking garages rather than the nation's business.
In his address over the weekend, President Obama seemed maybe inclined to agree.
Given the deficits that have mounted up over the past decade, we can't afford to make these investments unless we're also willing to cut what we don't need. That's why I've submitted to Congress a plan for a three-year budget freeze, and I'm prepared to offer additional savings. But as we work to reform our budget, Congress should also put some skin in the game. I agree with those Republicans and Democratic members of Congress who've recently said that in these challenging days, we can't afford what are called earmarks.
Aaron Billings, remind us, what were earmarks? Are they still going on? Are they really stopped now? What's the agreement that the Congress is reaching here?
Well, I don't know if there's really an agreement. Mm-hmm. Republicans obviously have campaigned on this issue. Earmarks are funding projects that are pretty much set aside in the appropriations bills. They're targeted funds for specific projects. And Republicans, conservative Republicans in particular, have recently made this one of their top issues. We just heard Jim DeMint. It has been a crusade of his. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting, the Senate has really been the backstop for keeping earmarks. They believe, McConnell has often said, as have many Democrats, that this is the constitutional authority that Congress has. They don't want to cede that ground to the executive branch, and that's been the argument for keeping them. What was interesting this week is that we pretty much have all Republicans on Capitol Hill saying that earmarks need to go. We need to have a moratorium. The House Republican Conference passed one yesterday. The Senate Republicans passed one on Tuesday. And really, all eyes are on the Senate Democrats because they're the only caucus. House Democrats have also put in place a moratorium. It's not as wide-reaching as the Republicans, but they also have a moratorium in place. The Senate Democrats, however, have not taken a position. And what's interesting is there is a big debate going on between some of the newer members of the Senate Democratic caucus and some of the older members. And I don't mean by age. I mean veteran versus junior. Some of the younger ones think that this practice needs to end. Claire McCaskill is kind of leading the charge in the Democratic ranks. Harry Reid, the majority leader, he tends to side with the old bulls, which, you know, these guys say, hey, we need to keep it. So what I'm interested in, and I think all eyes right now are on how the Democratic caucus goes forward. Right now, there isn't a consensus.
The debating right there. We'll look at that debate. Michael Crowley, you've been writing about this as well. I mean, before we get to the Democrats, give us the case, the Jim DeMint case. He points at earmarks as not just a budgeting problem in and of themselves, but a kind of gateway to corruption, as he describes it.
A gateway to socialism, I believe,
socialism
is the phrase,
okay.
The colorful phrase that he's used. Yes, I sat down with Senator DeMint a few days ago, and I have a story about him in the new issue of Time. And I do think that he makes a case that often gets lost in the back and forth. What is often said in response to complaints about earmarks is that they don't constitute a very large proportion of the budget. You could wipe out earmarks and you're not going to come anywhere near to balancing the budget, so therefore this is a charade. I actually think he makes a somewhat he also makes a somewhat different case, which I think is more substantive and important, which is that earmarks are a kind of way of greasing the skids toward bad legislation. So one example would be that the congressional leadership comes up with a bloated spending bill that kind of, you know, blows the budget, what people wanted to spend, and they buy off holdout members by saying, we'll give you a bridge in your district that we realize is not really warranted, but your constituents will like it. And the member says, okay, fine, then I can swallow this turkey of a bill. And the bill passes, even though it really shouldn't because it's not a good bill. The other example would be some cases we've seen where earmarks seem to have coincided with donations to members of Congress from business interests or lobbyists, and the earmark ends up helping that particular business, often far away from the place where the member of Congress actually lives. It looks extremely suspicious. I think that there's good reason to think that there is some correlation there. So earmarks, I think, can be a way to kind of corrupt the legislative process in a broader sense beyond its significance in terms of the dollar figures of the individual earmarks. In other words, the sum is great. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
I have to say, at least in your write-up, I found DeMint's argument here kind of persuasive. I mean, somebody sees a really terrible spending bill, but they're going to get some huge construction project in their home district, and you sort of buy their vote with an earmark. Are Democrats really going to stick up and stand up and for earmarks in this season, Michael?
It's hard for me to believe that they will. I think, you know, let me be cynical about Washington again. Maybe I'm in a cynical mood this morning. I suspect they may kind of put up a show right now because the politics are swirling and they will talk a lot about how bad earmarks are. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, you may see them creep back into the process. They might make some kind of a non-binding pledge. There will be loopholes. There will be other ways to do it. But I think at a minimum, Democrats have to, you know, at least broadcast the message that they don't want to tolerate earmarks, in particular because you have a lot of Senate Democrats who are up in 2012 in states that are not particularly friendly to them right now. So as one example, Clara McCaskill from Missouri has signed on already to a bipartisan earmark plan, kind of distancing herself from her leadership. I think you may see more and more of that to the point where effectively, you know, any vulnerable Democrat has signed on, even if Harry Reid maybe isn't quite going to the rafters on the issue.
Jack, I want to get to Charlie Rangel, but a couple of callers first. Rick in Essex, Vermont. Rick, you're on the air.
Thank you. As a lifelong moderate Republican, I tend to agree with DeMint on many issues. However, I feel overall that Mr. Boehner and some of those folks could very well be misreading a lot of us moderate Republicans, and it could come to bite them in the hindsight in a couple of years.
Misreading on what front, Rick? Misreading where? How?
Misreading this no to everything Obama and not cooperating with President Obama. We need to get stuff done. And that means backing off a little bit on some of this Limbaugh, Palin-type rhetoric and getting to work and getting things done. They are, I think, misreading. A lot of us just sat out this last round because we're so disgusted with both parties. And that's just my comment and my feeling. And anecdotally, I hear an awful lot of that.
Rick, I appreciate your call. Aaron Billings, let me take that to you. There's Rick, a moderate Republican, and he thinks, you know, maybe John Boehner's reading him wrong. It may come back to bite. But is that what how the Republicans read the electorate at this point? Is the moderate sort of Rick-style vote what they're angling for? Are they, you know, are they at risk of getting too far out there with Jim DeMint and maybe losing the electorate, or do they see success in that direction?
I think at this point they think compromise is not going to win them back the Senate and certainly not the White House. I mean, their number one goal right now, and Mitch McConnell has made this very clear, the Republican leader in the Senate, that they want Obama to be a one-term president. And by giving him victories, and by that I mean compromising or coming up with bipartisan solutions, things that the president can say, look what I did. These are the accomplishments, you know, of the last 2 years. You should give me another term. I think the Republicans don't want to hand those types of things to the president because they want to win the White House.
But we're at a pretty critical moment here. You know, to play politics for 2 years could be costly as well, I would think. But, hey, I don't know. Rita in Iowa City. Rita, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I was calling because I was so disturbed by the juxtaposition of this contemptible behavior by the Beltway Republicans. And you contrast that with the amazing picture of Sal Giunta, the Medal of Honor winner.
Yes. From Iowa.
Yeah, yeah. He's the type of person who gives me hope for the future. And then you look at these Republicans, and I'm not calling all Republicans this, but these Beltway people who obviously don't care about what's good for America. They just, you know, want to score political points.
But, Rita, you know very well that that is not how Republicans would describe what they're up to here. Jim DeMint, as Michael was pointing out, says, look, these earmarks are really corrupting our system of considering, for one thing, budgets and leaving us with this big deficit. I mean, you may not like the style, but do you see real concerns, you know, reasonable concerns there?
Well, you know, Tom, if they really gave a hoot about the little guy, maybe they would you know, start by sharing the pain and back off from their salaries and their pensions and their health care. You know, maybe they could go to work for minimum wage. I'm not saying a dollar a year. I'm saying minimum wage. Let's see how far they can do on it. You know, during the George Bush reign of error, Americans were told that they didn't dare question the government, that it would be totally unpatriotic.
Yeah.
It would be That's supporting true. The terrorists mm-hmm. to do anything to question the president. Well, we're still in a time of war. So where's their supposed patriotism and their supposed respect?
Rita, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, wherever you are on the political spectrum, it was a tough juxtaposition this week to see that amazingly humble and strong in his humility, Army Staff Sergeant Sal Giunta, you know, and the camaraderie, the courage he represented in camaraderie, saving comrades, and then all around him, people are, you know, blocking and ditching right and left in Washington. It was tough to look at.
It was tough to look at. And, you know, I watching the president, I thought, well, isn't this a moment, Mr. President, for you to say we're all now going to pay a war tax? You know, Franklin Roosevelt said that paying taxes in wartime is a privilege. And, of course, as everyone has pointed out, these are the first wars we've ever had, going all the way back, that we haven't paid for simultaneously, that the public hasn't been asked to make that token sacrifice. And I must say, I was hoping the president would say, and I'm going to go to Congress tomorrow and say, we are going to pay for this war this year. I guess there's no chance of that. I also was hoping that maybe someone would say, shouldn't we? No, we can't afford to have a draft because it's too many people. But shouldn't we have at least some quadrant of the military decided by a lottery? You know, a small number of troops every year will be picked out of a very small sample.
Speaking of skin in the game,
Put everybody into the game. Now, of course, that would mean very few Americans would still go in, but all young Americans would be exposed to the real chance, the real possibility of being drafted. And I, you know, of course, that's a pie in the sky wish too, but. Seeing that this young man and his fellows and women are bearing all this for us, my God, shouldn't we bear some of it for them?
I have to say, his humility and courage really moved me. And with the turnover in Afghanistan now out to maybe 2014, maybe you're right, Jack. We'll look at that. Dave in Hartford, Connecticut. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi.
What do you think, Dave?
I couldn't disagree more than the moderate, quote-unquote, Republican from Vermont.
Right.
I think, need to do is get things undone. And if we can't get things undone, we should just not do anything until we can change hands with the parties. I think the government has been doing too much, bailing out GM, I mean, a stock option, so we get half our money back. Big deal. Obamacare, I mean, really, I think we should undo it. The federal government should get back to doing what it's supposed to do, which is doing the military, running the highways, doing the FDA. That's about it. I mean, this is Department of Education. You know, I think they're the exact opposite tack.
So when the Republicans say no, you say right on.
You got it. You got it.
Dave, I appreciate your call. Michael Crowley, I mean, you're writing about exactly this. Just, this last week, the banners outside the Capitol, you know, don't just stand there, undo something.
That was a great one. There was also a guy at this rally outside the Capitol dressed as Captain America waving a giant U.S. Marine Corps flag. I'm not sure what message he was sending, but I guess it was sort of all-purpose patriotism. But look, I think that what you've seen in these two callers is a kind of microcosm of the essential question facing Republicans in Congress right now, which is how confrontational should they be with the Obama White House in the name of their sort of core goals? And what this leads us to is the question of, you know, I think the destination at the end of this road is, will there be a government shutdown showdown like Newt Gingrich had with Bill Clinton in 1995? In other words, that if conservatives are going to insist, there will be no repeal of the Obama health care plan. There will be no massive spending cuts as long as Obama wields veto power and you have a lot of Democrats in the Senate. But, you know, the conservative Republican base is not going to be happy to see Republicans kind of throw up their hands and say, well, there's nothing we can do, so let's just kind of bide our time for a couple of years. A lot of them want to see very dramatic, vivid confrontation. And Republicans do have the ability to refuse to send the president a budget that he will sign. And that gets you into a game of chicken where Republicans say, you better sign this. And Obama says, no, I won't. And the result of that would be that the government shuts down, federal employees are sent home, national parks are closed. I would say that some vital services like Social Security checks, I believe, continue to be
cut. Let me ask you, Michael, I mean, national parks closing aside, they'll still be there, the trees will still be growing, we hope. But I wonder, as you're watching this NATO conference going on, this big sort of confrontation now with China over currency. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot going on in the world. This, our caller Dave says, you know, sort of undo, strip it down. But is stripping down the government, it's spending too much maybe, but will that work at a time when there's real competition out there? People are doing things. Other governments are doing and leading their countries. I mean, can we afford to sort of just strip it down, Michael?
Sure. Right. And, you know, what I think a lot of most, perhaps virtually all mainstream economists would say is that this is a terrible time to be cutting back dramatically, that government spending is needed to help boost the economy. There's also a debate about tax cuts and the role that they would play. Democrats and Republicans feel very differently about this. But the larger point is that I think enough Americans agree with what you are articulating that the sort of Jim DeMint Tea Party strategy of total confrontation, risking a government shutdown, risking, to give another example, playing chicken with a default on the national debt when there will be a vote coming early next year to raise the debt ceiling so we can continue borrowing. A lot of members want to go that way, but I think a lot of Americans may be very uncomfortable about that kind of approach, that kind of politics right now. So I think Republicans are nervous and not sure how this is going to play out and not sure whether this will be for the good if it does play out in such a confrontational way, because people feel the way that you just articulated.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Burma human rights champion and Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi was released after years of house arrest. Here's the BBC's John Simpson.
There was so much noise that even when I asked her what it felt like and all the usual questions, I couldn't hear really what she said. It was clear she was saying she was very, very happy.
Airline passenger John Tyner refused to undergo body scan and pat down. He recorded his conversation with TSA agents in San Diego on his cell phone.
I don't understand how a sexual assault be made a condition of my flying.
This is not considered a sexual assault.
It would be if you weren't the government.
The GOP's first push to a vote in the House post-midterms was to try to defund a certain news outlet. They failed. This time, here's Congressman Eric Cantor.
Eliminating taxpayer funding for NPR is precisely the kind of common sense cut that we have to begin making if we want to fundamentally alter the way business is conducted in Washington.
And British royal watchers were all aflutter this week as Prince William and Kate Middleton announced they would be tying the knot.
We've been talking about marriage for a while, so it wasn't a massively big surprise, but I took her up somewhere nice in Kenya and proposed.
It's very romantic. There's a true romantic in that.
There is.
Let's get a call right here from Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Thank you. I find myself deeply disturbed and downright disgusted with the lack of respect for due process of law in this country. You have, for example, a senator from a certain state, namely Massachusetts, who's an attorney but doesn't believe in due process of law, who's on judge advocate but doesn't believe in the Geneva Convention and doesn't even think that waterboarding is torture.
Are you talking about the Guantanamo detainee trial this week in New York, Bill?
Well, having said that, what was the alternative? Select a jury, tell them, hey, you're going to find this guy guilty? I mean, if we're going to have this kind of a kangaroo approach to justice, let's dispense with this liberty and justice for all phrase in the Pledge of Allegiance, and let's just admit, we're well on our way to becoming another police state. This trial ended up exactly the way it should end up. You don't use evidence that's been obtained by torture because it's not evidence. And number two, you go by what the evidence is, and that's exactly what the jury did.
284 out of 285 counts, not guilty. I mean, that one will probably keep Ahmed Gailani in prison for a long time, but what if even that one hadn't been there? Are you willing to see Guantanamo detainees just go free if they're suspected of having been involved?
2 points to be made here. If torture hadn't been involved, maybe more of the charges would have stuck. But having said that, I would much rather have that type of a person get away, if you want to put it that way, than have my entire concept of a system of justice, everything that we stand for, go by the board. You know, we can be subverted from the outside, which isn't very likely, or we can subvert ourselves, which is highly likely. And that looks like that's the path on which we are headed.
Bill, I appreciate your call. Aaron Billings, where do you see future prosecutions going after this? I don't know. Did it look like a close call to the Department of Justice this week? One guilty verdict out of 285?
Well, certainly they weren't spinning it that way, and the Obama administration said after the verdict was rendered that, they signaled that civilian and military trials would both go on. I mean, that's the big political argument. I mean, do we have these detainees tried by civilian courts, or do we have them tried by military tribunals? And I think that the debate rages anew. I mean, this is something that we've heard on Capitol Hill for the last couple years and the last year in particular. And then we get to the argument over Gitmo and its closure. And Obama, obviously, on his first day in office, said he was going to close Gitmo. That obviously hit the skids pretty quickly. Republicans said no way. And I think that we're going to hear that debate all over again.
Michael Crowley, will the Obama administration sort of go back to the drawing board on this, or do you see a commitment to keep putting these prosecutions out there, these trials, one after another in civilian courts?
Well, I guess I won't pretend to know exactly how hard they're going to pursue the civilian trials, but I tend to think that this, however they may describe it as a victory, I think this has probably rattled them. You've seen now that, they're in very much in a holding pattern with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. There had been talk about trying him in New York. It appears very unlikely now that that's going to happen, and he may just kind of languish in a sort of extra legal limbo for a long time. To me, we just have kind of a crazy quilt system right now, and it's really leaving everyone unsatisfied. It's a terrible conundrum. I come back to, one way I think about this is, imagine if a defendant like this was acquitted and, say, went back to his home country or went to Yemen or the tribal areas in Pakistan, couldn't we essentially track him and then blow him up with a Predator drone? And wouldn't that be very much par for the course with what we're doing every day? I mean,
par for the course, that's a kind of, there's a kind of vagueness around that. Would that be justice?
Well, this is the question. What I'm saying is that we have a policy of sort of extrajudicial assassinations that we carry out on a daily basis. We are killing militants and alleged terrorists constantly in Pakistan, Yemen, and Afghanistan. But there is sort of tremendous hand-wringing about trials here in the United States. Now, that's appropriate that we have a very detailed and difficult debate about our justice system. But I guess what I'm saying, Tom, is that we have a crazy quilt system right now. No one is satisfied with it. I think it doesn't really make legal sense. And they're just still figuring it out.
Sanctioned assassination. Jack, you could let him swim into Guantanamo Bay and shoot him.
Yeah,
I mean it's grotesque, but I mean that's essentially what Michael's saying. That's the inconsistency in our policy in a way right now.
Yes, and there was a Republican congressman who said, I hope that he would never get out of Guantanamo alive. Kind of bravado. You know, I was struck. The New York Times points out today that there have been four minor guilty verdicts in the military tribunals, and this very serious 20-year, perhaps more, sentence out of the civilian courts. And they also point out that the military tribunals don't allow coerced testimony either. So the claim, John McCain has been making it, that a military tribunal would have been tougher, that doesn't seem to hold up to the precedents from the past. And of course, as Bill reminds us, you talk about the burden that Americans... I mean, we have never done this before. We have never officially tortured people. That has never been the national policy. And President Bush just 2 weeks ago said, hell yes, when he was asked about torture. That's a moral benchmark for this country that we may live to regret. And that, God help us, some of our... some American soldiers in enemy hands someday may regret.
Of course, it was the torture that led Judge Lewis A. Kaplan in the Federal District Court to refuse to allow a lot of testimony from important witnesses, apparently, in this case. More to come there. And again, I'm maybe too vivid there. It is grotesque to imagine, but that's kind of what Michael Crowley is saying. If they're back out in the world, those drones are up there, and they do drop death. Steve in Nashville, Tennessee. Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. I have a question also about the big news story of the Russian arms dealer, the merchant of death there. I forget his name.
Boot.
On this arrest, I mean, this is a big arrest that was made, and I don't hear much of it on the news where I am. So I would like to know what your thoughts are on it. Since we're talking about detainees, and
yeah, absolutely, we'll pick it up.
This is a big deal.
Victor Boot out of Thailand, and a lot of tension between between Russia and the United States on this arms dealer who fed arms into so many conflicts around the world, and was hired by the United States to get material into Iraq in the early days of that war. I mean, the U.S.-Russia relationship fraught again right now. Michael Crowley, President Obama, hoping for a kind of rapprochement there. And between the nuclear treaty and maybe the boot deal, things must look tense again. Why are the Russians concerned about what happens to Victor Boot?
Tom, I have to confess, to illustrate the caller's point, this is not a story that I'm particularly familiar with.
Fair enough.
The only thing I can say is that our relations with Russia right now are kind of toggling back and forth. So there will be a diplomatic breakthrough and a happy meeting, and then the Russians will do something anti-democratic and repressive, and then we'll seem to have an agreement where they crack down on Iran, but then it turns out there's a back door and they are not living up to their commitments when it comes to Iran. So we right now have a bit of a schizophrenic relationship with Russia, and I think incidentally, that's one reason for some of the conservative opposition to this START treaty. Some of it may be cynical politics. I think some of it is a real frustration with the direction of Russia. But I have to confess, I couldn't go into detail about the particular story the caller is concerned about.
Steve, I promise you we'll keep an eye on Victor Boot as that whole situation rolls forward. There was a big situation on the automotive front this week with GM going back into the public markets, issuing stock just a year after filing for bankruptcy and getting about $50 billion in federal bailout money. Here was GM CEO Dan Akerson talking with CNN yesterday about the turnaround.
These are world-class platforms we're building today. And you think about it, well, how'd that happen?
Well, through it all, and all the machinations at the top of the corporation and the government involvement, people stayed focused on, you know, designing, building, and selling the best cars. It's inspirational how good the company has come out of this, and it's largely because of the employee base.
Came out at $33 or so a share, went up a couple of dollars on the first day. The U.S. taxpayer getting a chunk of that bailout money back, not everything yet. President Obama was happy to talk about it. The stock offering said it was a sign of a strengthening recovery.
We are finally beginning to see some of these tough decisions that we made in the midst of crisis pay off. And I'm absolutely confident that we're going to keep on making progress. I believe we're going to get through this tougher and stronger than we were before. Because just as I had faith in the ability of our auto workers to persevere and succeed, I have faith in the American people's ability to persevere and succeed. And I have faith that America's best days and American manufacturing's best days are still ahead of us.
Aaron Billings, we saw an interesting op-ed piece this week from Warren Buffett, the big sort of legendary investor, saying, you know, thank you, Uncle Sam, for having stepped in back in those dark days and done enough to keep the country, the world, from a complete economic meltdown. GM's back in the market now, got some money of its own, capital back in its pocket. Is this, does it look like something that will wipe away the stain, the pain of that bailout, Aaron? Or does that remain as a big political, I don't know, landmine?
Oh, it remains. It remains. I do think that the administration believes that the auto industry is a bright spot. We heard the president a few months ago kind of crowing about the progress that the auto industry had made and, you know, making the case that, in fact, these bailouts made sense and they were the right way to go. But as you know, bailout is a bad word anymore. It is a negative word. It is Republicans have really done a pretty good job messaging and making this bailout to be part of a broader political argument for how the administration, this administration, does things. So, no, I think that we're going to still hear this argument back and forth. I think that I don't think that minds have changed. I don't even think if the economy turns around in the next 2 years, Republicans will change the argument that just throwing money at a problem is the correct one, correct answer. Mm-hmm. I guess that was a long way to say no.
Maybe even Warren Buffett doesn't have a big enough megaphone there. Anthony in Toronto. Anthony, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I was just wondering, would it be fair for President Obama to take credit for what happened at GM?
Okay. Jack, what do you say? I mean, GM's still there. They're still in business. Now they're back in the public markets. They're raising capital. Is it fair for President Obama to take some credit for that instead of a big hole in the donut there?
It is, and it's fair for President Bush to take credit, too. He started the bailout in December of, 2008. I've been looking back. Senator Shelby from Alabama called the GM bailout the road to socialism. Lamar Smith of Texas called it Obama's war on capitalism. Well, it didn't look like a war on capitalism yesterday. It's strange. Conservatism, at least Burkean conservatism, is supposed to be all about responding to the world as opposed to some preconceived idea about it. And yet, again and again on these cases, you sense that the conservatives are a little like the Irish statesman who said, well, it's all very well in practice, but how does it sound in theory? In theory, it doesn't sound good. But look at the practice. Isn't that the American genius, that we don't bother about theories? We look at how things work. This seems to have worked. And it may actually yield the government over time some small profit. It certainly has saved over 1 million jobs, perhaps more. Some people think it saved the industry because if GM had gone down, it would have pulled down all the parts suppliers and so on. It looks like it worked. And yet some Republicans keep saying, well, how does it sound in theory?
Well, I mean, yes, those jobs, a bunch of them are still there. Michael Crowley, on the other hand, people just don't like the idea of a bailout. People want things standing on their own bottom. And this week we saw the financier who oversaw that federal rescue of GM himself accused in a kickback scheme around finance and, with the state pension system in New York. I mean, you sort of tie it all together. There is unhappiness on so many sides with what happened in the fall of 08, even now. Unease left over from that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was an interesting day for Steve Rattner. And, the joke was, if you saw him, did you congratulate him or you know, sort of give your condolences on the day when GM has a successful IPO and he's sued, I believe, by the New York Attorney General? I think on the question of the bailout, you're right. I mean, people don't like the idea of bailouts in principle. I mean, this applies to the question of the politics around the TARP bailout of the banks. It looks like the government may turn a profit from the TARP bailouts. But, every sense I get from the conservative base is that that doesn't satisfy them. They think that there was moral hazard. They think that bailout money could have gone to more deserving people, maybe homeowners, for instance, who were losing their houses. And in the case of GM, there is a conservative complaint that the bailout came without enough tough, restrictions or reforms for the unions, for the labor unions. It's often described as a union bailout by conservatives. And so I think that they're not really satisfied by the idea that we're going to make back some or all of the money. I will say that the polling on this has gotten a lot better. Last summer, it was something like 20% of the country approved. I think we're now about to half and half. So it could end up being a political winner, but there still will be a lot of discontent, particularly on the right.
Politics all over this week, even at Dancing of the Stars. Brandy voted off, and Bristol Palin headed on up with a lot of call-in votes from maybe Tea Party supporters right there. You just can't escape it these days. Michael Crowley with Time Magazine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Aaron Billings at Roll Call, thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Here's Bristol Palin's Dance and Song, Britney Spears with Gimme More. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.